This is Molly Hemingway of The Federalist. Join me, my husband Mark of Real Clear Investigations, 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, Aaron Wren of The American Conservative, and others for the 2024 Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, July 12th and 13th in Chicago. issuesetc.org.
Do you see NPR and its shift to the left as sort of singular to that organization, or of a piece with a much broader trend that's happening inside legacy media institutions?
It's much broader within legacy media organizations. I think it's very commonplace. For me, what's different about NPR is we are a public service institution. We have a public mission, and we have a show called All Things Considered. We have a fellowship called the Reflect America Fellowship. So I think we have a particular obligation to reflect America, to understand people from all different outlooks, to bring up things that might be uncomfortable for our progressive audience members, to be a little more daring, to take a little more chance, to be more curious about things that don't fit the narrative. So I think at NPR, it was a particular problem because we're a public institution. And you know, for years, I think a lot of people felt NPR was like a national trust.
That's Uri Berliner of National Public Radio and Barry Weiss of The Free Press. They're talking about an article that appeared in The Free Press. I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. It's an article that I've been waiting, as a lifelong listener to NPR, I've been waiting to read for decades. Anyone who has listened to NPR over the years realizes that there has been a shift, not just politically to the left, but a shift in their approach to telling the stories that are in the news, which is probably more disturbing. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Wednesday afternoon, April the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to start out with Terry Mattingly, author of the National On Religion column, talking about that column for the Free Press. Pastor Larry Peters joins us after that. We'll discuss church altar guilds. We'll spend some time with Pastor Will Wheaton. Looking forward to Sunday morning, the third Sunday in Easter, Good Shepherd Sunday then. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for Faith and Mass Media. He is author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McMeel Universal Syndicate. And for two decades, he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Should anyone be surprised by what Berliner said, or merely by the fact that he said it out loud?
It's the latter, of course. I think people like you and me, who grew up listening to NPR, and I have several images for our listeners that I think will help explain some of why this is so emotional. When I was writing the final pieces for Get Religion, I used a quote in which somebody referred to the New York Times as a church that doesn't change. And I would assume that that language can be applied just as much or even more to NPR, because NPR is a national trust. And more importantly, NPR exists as a critical institution in all parts of the United States. It is like the embassy of the Washington, D.C. mindset that is located in all college towns and all blue zip codes, even in the deep, deep reddest of states. To me, in my own life and experience as an NPR listener, the moment when this really hit me goes a long way back, and that was in 1983. My wife and I were moving from Charlotte, North Carolina, where I had been at the Charlotte Observer, and we were moving to Denver, Colorado, for me to become the religion writer and columnist at the late Rocky Mountain News. May it rest in peace. And this involves driving across Kansas. Now, I had never driven across West Kansas before. And, you know, the old saying, diamonds are forever. West Kansas is forever. And so we were in two cars, driving our two cars across, and I had NPR on, because all across the vast expanse of hardly populated West Kansas, there are NPR towers, you know, from county to county to carry the NPR signal all the way across that farm belt. Now, I knew that because when I lived in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and attended the University of Illinois and did my graduate work in the same building as the NPR station, I knew how important National Public Radio is to agriculture news because of its government subsidies and the fact that these stations are everywhere. So as you were driving across Kansas, it happened to be during an NPR fundraiser. Now, anyone who is a devotee of NPR, or it was at any stage of their life, you know that during an NPR fundraiser, they might as well have like a church organ come on in the background playing "Just As I Am," you know, like an altar call, because there's no reason for you to donate your money, but you know, they're giving you all the reasons why you need to support the NPR community and support NPR as an institution in American life. And like I said, they might as well have had a church organ on tremolo playing in the background. It was so intense. So we're driving out across Kansas, and we're driving from little radio towers stuck in the cornfields and wheat fields from one to another. And at each of these towers, there's a little office, or at least there was then. Maybe digital has changed that. But there were small segments to where the local people could sign on a couple of times a day and give the weather in that part of Western Kansas. I mean, huge, massive expanses. And what was really interesting was listening to the people when they were doing the financial appeals, the local people. It was like they knew their listeners by name. And it was very kind of unprofessional, like, okay, we're nearing the top of the hour in our fundraising call, and you know, we haven't heard from George yet over at the community college, and we still need to hear from – it was that kind of personal connection. But the more I listened, it wasn't just about agriculture. The way I would describe it is that the NPR listeners of Western Kansas was like everyone west of Salina and Wichita who had a subscription to The New Yorker. It was like we're stranded out here in Western Kansas together. And if we don't stand together, we'll lose our NPR connection to what we know is the real world. And the real world is not Western Kansas. It's New York and Washington and politics and books that nobody in Western Kansas but us are smart enough to be reading. And it was, frankly, an elitist community in the wilds of Western Kansas. And I was listening to that, and I went, you know, that's exactly why I listened to NPR when I was a high school student and a college student in Texas. The whole goal of that NPR tote bag and that NPR coffee mug was to be able to show that even though I go to a Southern Baptist university, I'm an NPR kind of person, and you're not. And that was true in the 70s and 80s. And NPR, for all of its excellence in so many ways, and I think we can agree with that, has continued its evolution to be the definitive high church altar of a particular mindset of urban, sophisticated, used to be liberal life in the United States. The symbol of it, the College of Cardinals would include NPR for that approach to life. And that's why it's so fascinating that this essay is running at the Free Press, because the Free Press has become the institution – that is crying out about the changing of liberalism, old-fashioned American viewpoint liberalism, into illiberalism that no longer allows certain viewpoints to be heard and no longer allows half of America to be a part of the equation of American democracy. And it was like the letters to the editor that got the ombudsman of the New York Times fired because she was quoting liberals who were upset about how blind the New York Times had become to life in America. And I think that's the essence of what we're hearing in this amazing article by Berliner and the fact that it ran in the Free Press. This is a debate between old First Amendment liberals and the new anti-First Amendment illiberals. Do you think that's too hot a take?
Not at all. I'll tell you my story. I used to listen to National Public Radio. I still do, but I used to listen to National Public Radio because I wanted to kind of check what I was hearing in against the more conservative news and talk outlets. It was kind of a touchstone, okay? If they were talking about a story, I knew they leaned left, but they would probably tell both sides of the story. The way people used to read the New York Times way long time ago. Now I listen, I call it opposition research, because I can be certain that what I hear on National Public Radio, regardless of the subject, is going to tell me exactly what the, I will say, extreme progressive voices want to hear. And since I do not consider myself a member of that camp in any shape, matter, or form, and I do communicate for a living, I want to know what the other side's saying and what they're thinking. Opposition research. What are your thoughts?
Obviously. I mean, when I was working in Washington, D.C. full-time for a decade, I heard many a conservative say, you know, the problem with Republicans in this town is that when they drive around in their car, NPR is still the first button on their radio. And they were saying that they took the worldview of NPR so seriously that they were tempted to think that it wasn't opposition research, that it was the very voice of reason in Washington, D.C., Beltway land. And that at some point, people were going to have to admit they couldn't attend that church anymore. That NPR had turned into a church that was hurting their ability to understand the point of view of their own constituents. And notice we're not talking about Democrats here. Although I wrote my column this week is my annual column marking the anniversary of the creation of the On Religion column for Scripps Howard years ago. I'm headed into year 36 next year. I have been doing this a while, and I always write about the state of religion beat work. And I chose this topic before the NPR piece ran. And my piece this week is about how journalism's real problem with religion, and particularly with traditional forms of religion, is not a matter of articulated political or even moral creed or dogma. It has to do with culture, that journalists tend to have grown up in a particular culture. The elite journalists in particular, they went to certain schools, you know, they have certain things in common, they value the same things in life. And I take a lot of this, and I quoted it in my piece from a former Scripps Howard colleague of mine named Peter Brown, who was a good, solid, secular liberal. But he began to be worried about the future of journalism because of the issue of viewpoint discrimination and that newsrooms didn't realize how monoculture they were. And Peter wrote a book which never got published. And I believe it didn't get published because – and he told me that, you know, the secular publishing houses and the academic public houses didn't want it because it made the journalistic left and the journalism mainstream very uncomfortable. And conservative publishing houses and even Christian publishing houses, they didn't want it because of who he was. He was a liberal. He was not going to go on the Pat Robertson show and be able to sell this book to that audience. But he had a fascinating concept for his book research. Well, this is going to tie into NPR here in just a second. And he knew that he couldn't do another survey on media bias because journalists were no longer being honest about this. So he had to come up with some methodology that was neutral. And what he did was he wrote one of the major journalism organizations, and he said, I don't want to know the names of your members. I don't want to contact them. I don't want to do anything in any way that would make them susceptible to pressure or negative feedback. All I want is the full zip code for their address and their street address in their city. That's all I want. And the organization concluded, okay. So what he did is he studied the elite zip codes of the Upper East Coast, Washington, obviously, New York, obviously. But he also chose a selected number of media markets across the United States, including Little Rock, Arkansas, and Knoxville. And of course, Knoxville was the one that got my attention. And we were having these conversations probably about mid-90s was when he was trying to get this research published. So what? We're talking, once again, 30 years ago. Anyway, here's what he found out. He gave the zip codes to a professional marketing analyst company. And folks, if you give them the full zip code, including the extra four numbers at the end, which break it down to street level or whatever, a market analyst can tell you incredibly detailed information, neighborhood by neighborhood. They can predict where, you know, whether you go to church, whether you don't go to church, how many children you have, what's the divorce rate, where do the people go to school, where do you shop, what are your – all of that's the stuff that market analysts have to be able to know when they're doing targeted advertising. And journalists across the country tended to live in neighborhoods that the experts gave names like Bohemian Mix, or another neighborhood was called Money and Brains, unquote. And they found out that these people were much more likely to be single or divorced. If they were married, they had like one child, maybe. They all read The New Yorker. They read The New York Times. They were highly likely to. These were the people who never went to yard sales in the suburbs. They preferred to go to theater productions downtown. They ate at urban delis, not, you know, at chain restaurants and shopping malls. They were urban elites. And I told Peter he should have named this book Baby Boomer Urbanites from Hell. That I thought that would have sold some copies. But here's the single thing that's important, and this is where NPR fits in. NPR is a huge part of life in those neighborhoods out in Middle America, Bible Belt America, West Kansas America, Utah. Wherever you go, there are little pockets of Bohemian Mix. And that is very likely to be where the journalists, or a high percentage of the journalists, live. In fact, Peter found that the difference between journalists and their audience, the journalists doing the news and the people consuming the news, the gap in their lifestyles was even greater in a place like Dallas than it was in a place like New York City. So that to some degree, the journalism mindset of which National Public Radio, the New York Times, and whatever, was a critical element in the culture, that was just as likely or more likely to affect the news in Knoxville, Little Rock, Houston, Dallas, Oklahoma City, Kansas City, etc., than it was Washington, D.C., and New York. And I found that fascinating. And I think to some degree, this is where Berliner's piece continues. There's five separate references. And the crucial moment in the entire piece, when you say, why did he dare to do this? It's when he says that, I'll read this paragraph. And North Star here is a reference to the NPR's decision that diversity of race, gender, sexual orientation would be the North Star of the network. So out of frustration, on November 6, 2022, I wrote to the captain of ship North Star, CEO John Lansing, about the lack of viewpoint diversity and asked if we could have a conversation about it. I got no response, so I followed up 4 days later. He said he would appreciate hearing my perspective and copied his assistant to set up a meeting. On December 15, the morning of the meeting, Lansing's assistant wrote back to cancel our conversation because he was under the weather. She said he was looking forward to chatting and a new invitation would be sent, but it never came. I won't speculate about why our meeting never occurred. Being CEO of NPR is a demanding job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is now established what this article is about. It's about the lack of intellectual and cultural viewpoint diversity in NPR. A journalism friend of mine told a story, and this is also from like the 1990s. In his newsroom, it was Diversity Day, and they were talking about how important diversity was, and diversity was going to be the chain that owned this newspaper wanted to stress diversity more and more and more. And so he said, for example, we've stressed racial diversity. Would all of our African-American personnel, you know, stand up, and they stood and everybody applaud. Latino stood up and applaud. And they went on. And at the end, my friend raised his hands and said, I have a question. Latinos tend to be highly Catholic or Assemblies of God. Could I ask for people to raise their hands if they are a practicing, active Latino Catholic? Like one hand. How about Assemblies of God or Pentecostal? None. Okay, among the African-American staff, how many of you are active in a Baptist or a Pentecostal church? None. And so his point was, to some degree, in terms of a moral and cultural worldview, the efforts to build the diversity of that newsroom really hadn't affected the newsroom all that much, because you still tended to have people who believed the same things on the moral and cultural and, yes, frequently political issues that are most divisive in our culture. And when you read Berliner's piece and then you do some specific research on NPR, you'll find that, yes, the racial riots and arguments and battles, you know, about Black Lives Matter were crucial. But if you look at NPR over the last two decades, what you really see is a massive shift on whether they can do any kind of fair or accurate coverage on moral, cultural, social, and religious issues. There was a time when NPR religion coverage was excellent, but I don't think I could use that adjective at all about the last two decades or so. And I did a search for polyamory, you know, the post-monogamous concept of sexuality. And I just did a survey for NPR polyamory and then did a news search for that. And you get pages and pages of hits on NPR features about polyamory. And I can only conclude that polyamory must be a very important issue to the staff that runs NPR, that it must have, that must be an important doctrine in their church, so to speak. And I guess there's a purpose in publishing a guide to post-monogamous life, which NPR basically did, like I think it was last year. But can you imagine them doing that kind of material about any traditional form of religion, whether it's Orthodox Judaism or Latin Rite Catholicism or the rise of Eastern Orthodoxy or whatever? I can't see that happening. So that was a long answer, but to me, that's the heart of this piece by Berliner, which is viewpoint diversity. And what he means by that is intellectual, cultural diversity.
We'll talk more about viewpoint diversity. We're discussing a column for the Free Press titled, I've been at NPR for 25 years, Here How We Lost America's Trust. It could also have been titled, Donald Trump Broke National Public Radio. We'll discuss that too next.
So if you think that, you know, you still live in a country where there's going to be some respect for your beliefs, you know, you could end up, you know, on the wrong end of a criminal prosecution.
Aaron Wren of the American Conservative talking about his presentation at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
And so that might be, of course, unfair or in many ways, but it's also reality. If you don't understand the changes that have happened in the world, then you're not going to be able to make sense of what you see around you. And again, you might actually disadvantage yourself by taking actions that 20, 30 years ago would have been no big deal, but today might destroy your life.
You can meet and hear Aaron Wren making the case for Christianity in a negative world at this year's Making the Case conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. You'll find additional information and you can register at issuesetc.org.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
What is chastity? Chastity can be defined, says Stephanie Neugebauer, as submitting the whole self, particularly one's sexual self, to God's good design and purposes. If you want to learn more about what it means to be chaste, to live a chaste and decent life, pick up your copy of the April issue of the Lutheran Witness, in which we discuss chaste community. Visit cph.org/witness to order a copy, or visit witness.lcms.org to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're discussing a column for the Free Press titled, I've been at NPR for 25 years, Here's How We Lost America's Trust. Terry Mattingly is our guest author of the National on Religion column for the Andrews McMeel Universal Syndicate. So, Terry, I was reading this, and it's a massive article, by the way, from Uri Berliner, and the second half of it was basically a laundry list of stories at National Public Radio, all of them Trump-related, that they either misreported on or got wrong. But more egregious is the fact that, as Berliner points out, when their reporting is proven wrong, there's no attempt to correct it. There used to be a section in every newspaper was something like corrections and retractions. Where is that now?
It's an embarrassment. And it's not there in large part because they probably don't believe they were wrong. I think they probably believe that eventually they will have information showing that Donald Trump really was working for Vladimir Putin. But the key is, you remember, I'm old enough to remember Vietnam very explicitly. In fact, I was in one of the last draft lotteries. And there was a saying that people used to use in the Vietnam era, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. And I think to some degree, that's what people at NPR are saying. We had to destroy free speech in order to save it. Because if we didn't block all of these viewpoints that are not worthy of being platformed at NPR, that's the big word now, platformed. if we didn't prevent them from being on the station, their bad disinformation would reach the public, and that would be a threat to democracy. So to some degree, from a free speech perspective, we had to destroy that village in order to save it. If we allowed dangerous people to talk about the Biden laptop, the origins of the COVID-19 virus, and a host of other issues, if we allowed people on the air to discuss that, we would hurt America. And I think they sincerely believe that. And this is a part of the whole internet era business model issue that we've discussed so much and that I wrote about in that piece for the Acton Institute Journal, Religion and Liberty, in which I argued that we live in an age where biased news is good business, kind of like the Pirates of the Caribbean saying, it's just good business. And from that perspective, to the perspective of current NPR leaders, viewpoint diversity is not good journalism because it makes their audience mad. And their audience are the members of the church of NPR. And it's critical to their worldview. It's critical to their self-identity. And that's why I still, to this day, meet people all the time who I would use the word mourn, M-O-U-R-N, mourn the fact that they no longer feel they can listen to NPR. Because the excellence of that network on so many subjects was critical to how they viewed the world and how they got their information about the world. And that NPR coffee mug on their desk was kind of a religious symbol to them of who they were as an intellectual and who they were as someone who wasn't like everybody else in America. I'm not an ordinary American. I'm an NPR listener. And I think that's the heart of this entire debate.
Berliner is quite clear he does not believe defunding NPR is the answer to this.
Yeah.
I think he still believes it could be reformed. But the numbers are not good for NPR, and he points it out near the end of that article. How big of an impact do you think this is going to have on, because it certainly started a national conversation, how big of an impact do you think it's going to have on, as you just mentioned, NPR's business?
Oh, I doubt that many NPR people will you ever even hear about this. But notice in the pretty solid NPR article responding to Berliner, which included a couple of different points of view and a devastating quote from the former head of the network. Let me see if I can find that. Let me do a search for viewpoint. You know, in which the man's name is Jeffrey Tvorkin. And he basically says, I know Berliner, and he's not wrong. And that's basically what he put in his tweet. And the fact that he said it on Twitter, of course, is crucial too, because that's the world now where Elon Musk lets lots of different people talk. And thus, NPR is, I don't believe they're on X anymore at all. I think they have boycotted Twitter, you know, because they believe it's dangerous now. Because of all this bad information that's coming out. So anyway, America lives in two different media cultures. I doubt, you know, that the late Rush Limbaugh would – well, okay, not, that's not true. If someone did a huge attack piece on Rush Limbaugh, he would probably spend about 3 hours on it, don't you think? And he would read it out loud – and from his perspective, he would slash it apart and he would laugh at it and joke at it, and his listenership would go up. I think the question is whether NPR listeners are ready to accept criticism of their church. And we'll have to see. their numbers do seem to be going down, including on mobile platforms. And I wonder, let me back up for a second. When I was in Washington, I used to take my students on tours of NPR, because all journalism majors from Christian colleges and universities all listened to NPR. And they always stressed that they needed to visit NPR because they knew the professors at their Christian colleges would all want to know that they went to NPR. And that would be the most impressive thing they could show. Their professor at home at their Christian college would be a picture of them sitting in the chair where All Things Considered is done. Because that's the point. At their Christian college, they were all NPR people. That's what made them journalism majors. And so during one of these trips, I was talking to kind of a junior level executive, and we were talking about the issue of them losing taxpayer funding. And I mentioned, you know, what if NPR just voluntarily dropped all the funding and signed some sort of agreement, or even NPR was purchased by Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post and the owner of Amazon, and one of the two or three richest men in the world? And what if NPR openly embraced that we have left the taxpayer dollars, we are now free to do what we want to do, and we're going to work with the Washington Post, and we are now your brand name for Washington Beltway Climate News? I said, wouldn't that financially, do you think that would be a good move? And I remember the people in taking part in the conversation all just saying, no, 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 we can't do that. We have to stay NPR. We have to stay NPR because that means we're all over America and we represent excellence all over America. Wherever there's an NPR station, NPR is alive and well and affecting that culture. So I think to some degree, and I hate to keep using this image, they can't close the church of NPR because they really believe that it is what they think it always has been. And as for Donald Trump and the Donald Trump angles on this, this issue with NPR is way older than Donald Trump. And if anything, Donald Trump just poured gasoline on these debates. I want to stress again for our listeners, this piece ran at the Free Press. And the Free Press is an institution that basically is dedicated to the defense of old school journalism liberalism, old school First Amendment liberalism. This is a debate between liberals and illiberals now. And I think that's what makes it so vitally important, because I bet you these arguments will be discussed in newsrooms, even if NPR listeners are not aware of them.
Has National Public Radio responded to Berliner's piece in any shape, matter?
And they say, of course, they say there are serious issues here. They're worthy of discuss. We care about people criticizing our content, but we think he's wrong. But their piece does include quotes, like I said, from Jeffrey Dworkin, the former ombudsman person and a major editor at NPR. And it kind of acknowledges that these debates about diversity are there, but they are defining diversity as gender, race, and sexual orientation. Viewpoint diversity is the fuse on this bomb. I dare say we won't see, you know, much discussion of that.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for faith and mass media. He's author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McMillan Universal Syndicate, and for 2 decades he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Larry Peters talking about church altar guilds. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is a collection of more than 600 hand-drawn Christian symbols by artist and author Edward Riojas. It's titled A Complete Guide to Christian Symbols. This new resource is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about A Complete Guide to Christian Symbols at issuesetc.org. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month, A Complete Guide to Christian Symbols.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service.
Our church loves and is grateful for those that serve our country. Operation Barnabas, part of Ministry to the Armed Forces, equips you to reach out to veterans in your community to bring Christ to those that served. Call Ministry to the Armed Forces at 314-996-1337 or email lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
God bless our military.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Teaching your student to read should not be complicated. Memoria Press's Phonics uses common sense and the classical approach with their First Start Reading program for the most effective and efficient way to teach your child how to read. If you're interested in learning more, visit them at memoriapress.com and use the coupon code LPR24 at checkout. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we continue in Galatians with Christian freedom, the offense of the cross, keep in step with the Spirit, bear one another's burdens, and do good to all. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.